Slow Burn Media, an evergreen podcast, presents Who Killed? A podcast that provides a voice for the voiceless.
All right, there we have it. He did identify the defendant in the courtroom. Matt, let me bring you back in as our analyst today and ask you, so what import is it that this person who was robbed at gunpoint now says that's the defendant who robbed me when we're in court on an unrelated murder trial?
Well, they're trying the prosecution's trying to get the gun that was stolen from that witness in that hotel room to be in the hands of the defendant, because ultimately it was the same gun that was used in the homicide and the assault of the Prices. So this is circumstantial evidence. They're trying to connect pieces. You know, here's the guy that committed the robbery. A gun was taken. That gun was used in the murder.
I want to bring on my guest, Matt Mangino, criminal defense attorney and former prosecutor. Matt, how are you today, sir?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure to have you on. So listen, look, I have the best of both worlds with you, and I think we have an interesting dynamic here. I'm former law enforcement. You're former prosecutor, now defense attorney. How do you think the defense did in that closing? Because he brought up some very interesting points, right? He talked about the gun range.
Well, his closing was very methodical. I mean, he went through each point that he thought he needed to convince the jury here that there was a reasonable doubt about this charge of murder in the first degree.
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of Who Killed? I am absolutely thrilled to be joined this week by a very special guest. A former district attorney is joining and blessing Who Killed this week, and that is one Matt Mangino. And thank you so much for taking time out of your crazy schedule to come on our show.
Well, thanks for having me, Bill. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it was great. We actually met at CrimeCon just a few weeks back and in Las Vegas, and we got talking. And you have a very interesting and intriguing background and have made quite the name for yourself in the world of true crime. And what have you been up to? Because it seems like a lot.
Well, as you mentioned, Bill, we crossed paths at CrimeCon, and that was exciting. I had an opportunity to present there on the death penalty, and we talked a bit about that. And my presentation was kind of a spinoff of a book that I've written on the death penalty, The Executioner's Toll, 2010. But I've also, you know, I've had an opportunity to do some additional writing recently for the crime report and the legal intelligencer in Philadelphia, as well as the Pennsylvania Capital Star. So, you know, I've had an opportunity over the years to write a syndicated column that was distributed by Gatehouse. So I've really focused a lot of my work on writing, and I've also had an opportunity, through, you know, Law and Crime Network and Court TV and other media outlets to talk about some of the leading cases of the day. So besides doing all that, I still practice criminal defense. And so it's really a fun and exciting time for me.
As they say, you have a full docket.
That's for sure.
Well, what is the, let's talk about that. You mentioned the case of the day or what's sort of going on. What is the latest thing that you've been covering?
Well, actually, the Depp Heard defamation trial, although it's not a criminal matter, it's not a true crime matter. It has these layers of different intriguing aspects, alleged domestic violence in that whole scenario, and how it's been involved in this really kind of toxic relationship between Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. It's made for great television. I'm not really sure what the end game for either one of them is in that case. I don't necessarily think it's doing much for either of their reputations, but it really is enthralling, and it really grabs people, and they're paying close attention to it.
You know, that's an interesting case for sure, because of the fact that it is being televised. You don't really see a lot of the inner workings of a domestic violence case, and let alone, you know, on court TV, because it's, unfortunately, it's not something that gets all of that attention. But when it's two big stars like, you know, Depp and Heard, like you're talking about, yeah, it does garner a certain amount of attention. And it does, I think it actually, in the long run, their end game, I don't know what it is either, because I don't think it's helping either their careers. But I would say the positive thing out of it is that it is bringing back the spotlight to domestic violence and how that is still extremely prevalent in society, whether it's, and it's becoming more, you know, and it's not to say I'm placing blame on either person, because nothing's been rendered, but, you know, to be a victim, if you're a male, is a much harder thing to come forward with. It's also extremely difficult if you're female. So, I mean, it's really, you're walking a tightrope. And I think that's why everybody seems so intrigued by this case, because they're kind of opening up the curtain to really what you don't really see inside celebrities' lives. And this is really one of those cases where you do.
Right. And I think what's happening to a certain extent, what people are seeing, they don't necessarily like. You know, because number one, it's hard to be sympathetic with a figure, either one, who, you know, flies around on private jets to private islands, brings their own doctor or psychiatrist or drug and alcohol treatment person to their private island, you know, to go through this whole process. So well, you know, we watch these people on TV and we watch them on movie theaters. I think what we're starting to realize is we're not like them. I mean, they don't live the same sort of lives that we do. And I think that really is going to have an impact on the empathy that jurors can feel for either one of these parties, because they're realizing, I can't relate to this. I can't relate to going on an alcohol binge for 5 days or a drug binge for 5 days and getting on my plane so sick that I'm not even conscious to get back to New York City for rehab. That I don't think jurors can really wrap their head around that.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I do think you're right. They've lost the empathy card as far as, you know, 'cause yeah, you're right. They don't live like us. We're very much, under the belief, and you know, maybe it's naive, but whatever, but it is one of those things you look at, and yeah, I mean, he's flying to private islands he owns.
Right.
He's spending $27,000 a month on wine. Like, yeah. These are things that, you know, they're not crimes. They may be crimes against your body, but you know, again, the domestic violence thing, I think that is the one positive spin out of it, is that at the end of the day, it is about domestic violence, and they're probably not going to walk away with, you know, it's probably going to be whatever, a wash. And then, but again, the spotlight was showing again how much this can be, you know, not even just in anybody's regular life, but in celebrities' lives. And even when you have all the money in the world and you think, oh, God, this is great, I have my own private island. Well, drug and alcohol issues, clearly there's no solution for that, especially if you do have an endless bank account.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, people suffer from that disease, whether they're multimillionaires or they're, you know, broke and have, you know, spent their last dime. The disease, you know, affects everybody in a similar way, and it's certainly not a positive way by any means.
Yeah, I definitely would agree with you on that one. So, what else has been going on? I mean, I saw that you were on, and you always seem to be on Nancy Grace, but
yeah.
I did see that you were talking about the OK Cupid stuff. I was just on your website, and what's going on there?
Well, yeah, you know, it's really a lot of fun to get a chance to argue a little bit with Nancy Grace on her program, you know, Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
You don't say.
And yeah, so that's you know, that's something that that makes this fun every once in a while when you do it. But you do really talk about some interesting cases, and the one case that you mentioned is the you know, Sacramento woman who had told her family that she was going to meet a guy that she met on OkCupid, which is an online dating service, and she disappeared. And right now there's no trace of her. And so, you know, it highlights a problem that's out there to some certain extent, and that is that predators and rapists will use these types of online services to meet people, you know, to meet victims. And I think, you know, while these online dating services really, you know, can fulfill somebody's dreams, and there are countless stories that people have met and married and they're living happily ever after. But I think you have to be, as someone who uses these services, conscious of the fact that not everybody out there is looking for a long-term relationship, and some people are predators. And so you should always be sure to let people know where you're going, meet in public places, you know, do those sort of things that protect yourself. And certainly, you know, hopefully if your goal is to have a long-term relationship, you find one, but you protect yourself in the process. And I think that's some of the things that Nancy Grace likes to get across to her listeners and to her viewers, is that you need to protect yourself.
100% and 100%. And I think you notice that when you are at an event like CrimeCon, where it's an 85% women that are in attendance. And a lot of that, and this is my belief in the years of working in true crime and in journalism, is that there's a desire to know what to look out for. And I think people like Nancy Grace, people like Jim Clemente, people like yourself, mm-hmm. you know, they bring out and they kind of highlight the things to keep aware of. And I think that's another reason why true crime podcasts are super popular, is that it gives an advantage to the listener, even if it's a false advantage. You know, maybe, you know, what they know that may not help them in that particular situation, but maybe it helps them and they don't even realize it because they didn't go and talk to that one person, or they just got a little sketchy feeling and they decided, yeah, probably not a good idea to go out with that guy. And so I think that's really great that, you know, you go on and you talk about that stuff, because these technologies, these apps, I mean, they're so prevalent, and you got to be careful.
Right. No, and I agree. And you know, even a podcast like yours, you know, it builds awareness. So like you said, people might not even realize that they're learning something that might protect them someday, but they hear about these scenarios, and all of a sudden when they find themselves in a situation, whoa, this doesn't feel exactly right. They might not even know where they got that little bit of information, and it might have been listening, you know, to your podcast. But those are the kind of things, you know, at least people who are aware of true crime, they have a certain level of consciousness that, hey, not everything is as it seems. And that skepticism, I think, is helpful, and it protects people as well.
I would agree 100%. I think that is actually extremely noticeable. I think there are a lot more aware people out there than there were 10, 15 years ago about what to look out for. I think that's great, because as much as we want to say that crime has been on the decline, it actually has been increasing in the past couple of years. So while we got to say that for about 20 years, yeah, crime's on the, you know, on the decline. Well, for the past, you know, few years, it's been on the rise, and violent crime, that is too. So it's a slippery slope that we're in right now. And, you know, you want to be everybody to be happy. Yeah, I mean, it's their right to go out and meet new people and go on these apps, but they also have to be smart and just have a backup plan too. You know, if you feel, again, if you have that weird feeling, don't do it. It's just the bottom line. That's the bottom line. Here's a question for you, like just to throw one at you. What was the most, was there a case that you had that you thought you had the suspect, but you were never able to bring charges? Because that's always one of those things that intrigues a lot of listeners. Like, like, do you know who it is? And you don't have to get like into detail, but.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's always, you know, scenarios like that. I mean, you know, one case that when I first was elected district attorney in Lawrence County, there had been really a horrible murder of three children and an adult. They were slashed with a knife. Their throats were slashed. The crime scene was just a huge puddle of blood. And there was no charges filed for a period of time before I was district attorney. And then the attorney general had been assigned the case before or right as I came into office. And ultimately, a guy was arrested, convicted of those cases, sentenced to death. His case went up to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, and he was granted a new trial. And at that second trial, he was found not guilty. So this crime now remains unsolved. And the question is, do you believe that the guy who was arrested and convicted and sentenced to death, who got a second trial and then was found not guilty, is that still the guy who committed the crime? Because, you know, finding somebody not guilty doesn't mean that you're saying they're innocent. You're meaning it means that the state has not met its burden of proof. They haven't been able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this person was guilty at the second trial. Or on the other hand, is that murderer still out there? This person that committed this very gruesome murder of children and an adult. You know, so that's that kind of case, you know, still, and I haven't been in the district attorney's office for close to 14 years now, but I still think about that case, and I still think about those victims, and I still think about, you know, was it the right guy the first time, or is this killer still running the streets?
That's very intriguing. That I mean, that case, except for the adult, it reminds me of what was just solved last week, or I believe it was last week, was the Girl Scout murders of 77. I'm sure you saw that. And that guy, there's another, that's the reason why I bring it up, is not just because of the fact that it was three kids, but the guy went on trial and he was found not guilty. But then again, now they come out with the new technology, new DNA abilities, and that's the guy. And it's just like, you know, luckily he was already in prison for other crimes. And he died in prison shortly thereafter. But to think that he could have been just walking the streets after he just got away with murder, it's kind of scary.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it certainly is frightening. And we know, you know, our criminal justice system is based on a system where you have to prove somebody guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And, you know, that's a difficult burden to meet, but it also built into that is the idea that, you know, we can't prove people guilty to some mathematical certainty, and we don't expect the system to find people guilty to a mathematical certainty. So built into our system is the idea that an innocent person could be convicted and that guilty people can go free. That's really inherent in the whole idea of proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's kind of a good lead into your book. I mean, to a degree, I mean, that is, give the listeners a little idea of what your book's about, because that's really It's a really intriguing way of going about writing a book.
Yeah, so when I start thinking about the death penalty, and I've prosecuted death penalty cases and have defended them as well, you know, everybody who writes about the death penalty usually writes from a certain bias. They're for the death penalty, they're against it. So they cherry pick all the cases that support their position and say, look how good or look how bad the death penalty is. What I wanted to do was take an unbiased look at the death penalty. And I thought one way to do that would be to look at all the executions in a single year. So I'm not cherry picking the good or the bad cases that support or don't support the death penalty. We're going to look at all these cases. We're going to look at the crimes. We're going to look at the investigations. We're going to look at the trials, the appeals, all the way up to the last words and the last meals, and, you know, mix in the constitutional law that's evolved over the last, 35 years, and, let the reader decide for themselves, do they support or not support the death penalty? It could have been any year. I just picked 2010, and it happened to be an interesting year because you had an execution by firing squad. You had an execution by the electric chair. You had a woman executed, which is really, unusual. So I thought that would be a good year to examine the death penalty.
That's really intriguing. And I think the listeners would probably, it would be a great book for them to read, because I think anytime you have that question or you leave that question up for the audience or the listeners or, you know, the readers, I think it almost empowers them to look at the case with a different perspective, because then it's sort of making them responsible for making the decision, even though they're not per se. It's just they get the opportunity to put their own two cents in, and that's something that people really like to do.
Right, and so, you know, it's interesting in the fact that you can examine these cases one on one, because each chapter represents one of the 46 persons who was executed, or you can look at them together. You know, one case that I wrote about was the 46th execution of 2010. So really the last chapter in my book. And the guy's name was John David Duty. Okay. And he was serving three life sentences in an Oklahoma prison. All right. And he decided that, you know, he was 49 years old. He had been there for 23 years. And he decided he didn't want to be in prison any longer. But he didn't have the courage to either try to escape or to kill himself. What he decided he was going to do was kill his way out of prison. So he was in the RHU, which, as you know, is kind of the jail within the jail, restricted housing. And he had a young cellmate named Curtis Wise. And he told Curtis Wise, he said, listen, let me tie you up, and then you can scream for a guard, and they'll come in, and what they'll do is they'll give you your own cell, and they'll give me my own cell. We'll have our own cell. So he ties up Curtis Wise. He agrees to it. And before Curtis Wise could call for a guard, John David Duty strangles him to death. Then he sits down and starts writing a letter to Wise's mother saying, you know, it was harder than I thought. It's not like you see on TV when they kill someone. And it's probably a good thing, because your son was just going to spend a life of crime and incarceration. Fortunately, they intercepted that letter before it ever left prison. But he also sent a letter to the DA and said, listen, sentence me to death and execute me, or I'm going to keep killing people here in prison. And so ultimately, he got his wish and he was executed for that murder. But you know, so that chapter, that person makes you say, wait a second, this should be the poster child for an execution for the death penalty. This is a guy that says, kill me or I'm going to keep killing. People have to decide, is that appropriate? Was execution appropriate for John David Duty?
Right. Because you basically granted a murderer his wish. And that's
right.
Seems kind of dirty. In a way,
Yeah, and I guess the other side of that is, you know, who, how do you house John David Duty? If he says, I'm going to keep killing until you kill me, how long does that, do you let that go on?
It almost seems like West, old Western justice, let's hang him in town square because he says he wants to die. So let's make an example of him. I mean, I guess I can see some moral quandaries there. I mean, there's definitely some definitely some questions that I would have as far as the ethics behind that.
If you look at Pennsylvania, for instance, my home state, there's 130 people on death row in Pennsylvania. Since 1976, the modern era of the death penalty after the Supreme Court brought it back, there have been three executions. Okay, all three of them were volunteers, which means they gave up their pill rights and said, "Execute me." There hasn't been a person executed involuntarily in Pennsylvania since 1962, yet they've had the death penalty on the books here since the beginning of the state. The state was organized. So. It makes you wonder, is that an effective punishment if you're only executing people who say, execute me?
It certainly does give you that. It gives the criminal sort of an idea of what they have in store for them. Like, oh, yeah, it's just kind of like California. You can go on death row, but you're not going to get executed.
Right. They have 700 people on death row and they've carried out 13 executions, I think.
It's, I mean, let's, and they have some of the worst and they don't, I don't know. I mean, it does make you wonder. I mean, but how about the woman that was executed that year? What was her crime?
Mm-hmm. Well, what she did was, she became friendly with a couple of young guys, who she ultimately began an intimate relationship with both of them. They were maybe late teens. And then she ultimately coaxed them into killing her husband. And, ultimately they did that. They killed her husband. They testified against her. She was in the state of Virginia. The issue was, she had become a model prisoner. In fact, she had become kind of like a confidant, leader, mentor to young female prisoners who were also in custody. And so there was a lot of review, a lot of thought that went into whether or not she should be entitled to a reprieve, clemency to change her sentence to life in prison. But ultimately, the governor wouldn't approve that, and she was executed.
Yeah, you look at some of those cases that end up like that, and you see people that turn their lives around or, go down a different path in jail. You see people go down the same path in jail. So you do sort of have to weigh those options, extenuating circumstances when it comes to this type of thing. I mean, you would know way better than any of us. I mean, did you personally, have to make any death sentences or put anybody on death row?
Well, as a prosecutor, I tried two capital cases. Both of those cases ended up as life without parole and not a death sentence. So, no, I was never responsible for putting anybody on death row.
Did you ever feel like, did you feel like those cases that you did prosecute and had them, potentially going to death row, did you feel like they warranted that?
I want to take a moment to tell you about my podcast, Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage. In 1984, a woman named Phyllis Cottle was abducted in broad daylight, tortured, and left to die in a burning car in Akron, Ohio. At the time, I was a rookie reporter covering this horrific story. Since then, I've reported every kind of crime imaginable. I've been able to leave most of them at work, but not this one. The one that buried itself under my skin and stayed put. Phyllis Cottle was a badass woman, and I want to tell you her story. A production of Evergreen Podcasts and signature title of the Killer Podcast Network, you can find Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage wherever you get your podcasts. Discover more great true crime and paranormal programming at killerpodcast.com.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. People don't always realize that physical symptoms like headaches, teeth grinding, and even digestive issues can be indicators of stress. And let's not forget about the doom scrolling, sleeping too little, sleeping too much, undereating, or overeating. I like to think that I deal with my stresses by taking a little bit of mindfulness each day. I do try to make it a point to focus on myself, because stress shows up in all kinds of ways. And in a world that's telling you to do more, sleep less, and grind all the time, here's your reminder to take care of yourself, do less, and maybe try some therapy. I've personally been in therapy since I was a child, and I would suggest it for everyone. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's so much more affordable than in-person therapy. Give it a try and see if online therapy can help lower your stress. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Who Killed Amy Mahalovic listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/who. That's BETTERHELP.com/who.
Well, yeah, I did. And if I didn't think they warranted it, I certainly wouldn't have sought that. And you know, the problem with the death penalty, and they tried to correct this problem to a certain extent in 1972 in a case, Furman versus Georgia, was that there really wasn't any guidelines for the death penalty. So there really wasn't anything that separated, you know, one first degree murder case from another. So you were getting similar cases being treated differently in different states, but you're also getting similar cases being treated similar, not the same in neighboring counties. So it was really kind of a toss up. And it's always been exclusively a discretionary decision by the district attorneys. So the Supreme Court tried to create some guidelines. So what they said in 1976 was, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to make the death penalty only for the worst of the worst. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to have what we call aggravating circumstances. So it's not enough just to be convicted of first degree murder. You have to do something more egregious, like kill a child or kill a police officer or kill a pregnant woman or kill somebody in the act of torture or having killed somebody in the past. So these aggravating circumstances, we're going to make it not just for anybody who committed first degree murder, but the worst of the worst. It really didn't work out that way. And one of the reasons is because as states began amending their death penalty laws, and over time, the way it evolved is they put kind of catch-alls in there that said, well, any crime that's particularly heinous. Well, I mean, murder's heinous. I mean, you know what I mean? So basically, you're back to square one. You can charge anybody. You can seek the death penalty against anybody who committed first degree murder because murder is heinous. You're always gonna have that sort of thing. And so, what in 72, what the court said was the death penalty was arbitrary in the way that it was being imposed. Okay, because there were no guidelines, there were no aggravating circumstances. So now we've evolved into a situation is where the question is, has the death penalty evolved and become arbitrary in the way that it's being carried out? And what I mean by that is last year there were 11 executions in the United States. There's 2,474 people on death row in this country. If at that rate, a significant number of those people are going to die of natural causes rather than lethal injection or some other means. You know, so back in 72, Justice Potter Stewart said that getting the death penalty was freakishly arbitrary, like getting struck by lightning. Okay. The question now is being executed, being one of those 11 out of 2,474, freakishly arbitrary, like being struck by lightning? How do you differentiate those 11 from the other 2,463? So that's where I think the death penalty is right now in terms of how it's being viewed.
It's super interesting. That's a super interesting perspective, because you read about when somebody's going up for execution, and you don't really, you know, they don't go into the nitty gritty. You know, I worked in TV. They don't talk about all these other cases that are still out there. And it's, you're right. Like, how do they select, okay, it's this individual's time to meet their maker. And it's that, the fact that there isn't a actual method, you know, right, method to the madness, I guess. It's kind of crazy to think that somebody's life can literally be in the hands of just such a few people, a few amount of people. And it makes you wonder about the whole thing in general, like freakishly arbitrary. Is the whole thing, mm-hmm, does it really do what it's supposed to do? I mean, if we're only putting 11 people to death, is that even a deterrent? Is that
right? I mean, well, that's a good question, and that's a question that a lot of people ask. You know, is the idea that you could be executed for committing a murder give pause to someone who's got a gun and is about to kill somebody? I don't think that it is. You know, I think the alternative would be if you were executing more people and in a quicker period of time, then it might be an issue that someone would contemplate. Hey, I could get executed for this. Just like people make that sort of cost benefit analysis and other crimes that they commit. You know, people say, hey, I'll give you an example. And I think it's an interesting example. So I spent 6 years on the parole board after I left the DA's office in Pennsylvania. So the governor at the time, Governor Rendell, appointed me to the parole board, and I did 6 years there. And part of our responsibilities, there were 9 board members across the state, was you would interview people who were eligible for parole, people who committed, you know, violent felonies. And you know, I would interview people who on occasion, you know, they would get arrested for an armed robbery, but the gun wasn't loaded. Okay, it doesn't matter, you know, if the gun's loaded or not. If someone perceives that threat, they have the gun. And I would say, well, why did you go there with an unloaded gun? And the guy'd be like, I don't want to kill anybody. You know, I wanted to commit a robbery. And the guy on the other side of the counter didn't know if my gun was loaded or not. So he was going to give me what I wanted. But I didn't want to make things worse and shoot him. You know, so when you think about that, it didn't deter him from committing that specific crime, but it deterred them from killing somebody, you know, because they made a decision. I didn't want this to get to the point where I'm shooting it out with somebody, I'm murdering somebody, but I do want to scare them and I want their money. So people rationalize, even criminals, about, you know, what could happen to them, you know, if they did such and such a thing. But the idea that 11 out of 2,700 or 474 people is going to get executed, I don't think gives anybody pause that you know, I don't want to face the death penalty.
Yeah, that's a very good point, though, that you brought up there about not loading the gun because they don't want to commit that crime. I also think that that's the type of person that individual is, because I think there are people who are criminals, but they don't want to have that over their head. You know, even if the death penalty is something that they get, they don't want to kill somebody. You know, they don't want to. Robbing them is one thing, but to them, killing them is a whole nother ball of wax, which it is. And right. And it just goes to show you that, yeah, criminals do think about that stuff before they go in, because if the gun's not loaded, then they have no option.
Right. Right. And it's kind of like, you know, a criminal's morality. I mean, yeah, there is some morality in these people, even though they're criminals. There are certain things they're not going to do. They're not going to try to kill somebody. They're not going to rape somebody. You know, they have kind of their own sort of set of deadly sins that I won't do, but everything else is on the table.
So here's a question for you in regards to when you were the district attorney. Did you prosecute, did you prosecute any cases where you were kind of the center of attention as far as like the local media, like, oh, this is the hottest case in, you know, the area, and, you know, we got to talk to, you know, Matthew Mangino and get his thoughts. Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly you were interviewed a lot, but was there any case that stood out to you?
Yeah, there were a couple of cases, and you know, where the county that I was the DA in was north of Pittsburgh, so we got all the media attention in Pittsburgh, and then it was just east of Youngstown, Ohio, and south of Cleveland. So you got there was a lot of media attention, especially. As you know, the news, you know, they like these kind of cases because people like to hear about them. But there was one particular case in which it was a thrill killing. Three young guys, you know, late teens, early 20s, had, you know, made this, you know, plot to, they wanted to rape and kill, you know, a young girl. And they talked about it, you know, sat around, smoked marijuana and talked about it, drank beer. And then finally, one day they snatched a 12-year-old girl off the street in Ohio, right across the line, brought her into Pennsylvania and murdered her. So this thrill killing was, as you can imagine, was a big case. Got a lot of media attention. One of the guys pled guilty, or I think actually two of them pled guilty to first degree murder. One who thought he had a lesser role in it went to trial, and he was convicted and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
That's a disgusting case. And what was the name of that? Do you remember the name of the girl?
Her first name was Shannon. I don't remember. Koss, I believe it was. Shannon Koss. K-O-S.
K-O-S. That is... Yeah, so I... Mm-hmm. Yeah, cases like that, I mean, when it affects a child, that those definitely have to stick with you mm-hmm. the longest.
Oh, yeah. Those kind of cases certainly have an impact on you. You know, we had a situation where there was a young couple, unmarried, who had twins. And one of the twins died. They were infants. And so we weren't sure what happened. You know, so obviously there's an autopsy. We think that there might be, you know, some foul play here. And at the autopsy, they shave the child's head. And when they shave the child's head, there you can see a handprint, basically, on the child's scalp. It was hit that hard in the head with an open hand that it killed the child. It killed the infant. And so those kind of cases, you know, and really, you think as a prosecutor you've seen a lot, but when I went on to the parole board in Pennsylvania and saw literally thousands of violent offenders, you know, from Philadelphia and all the other larger cities in the state, I realized I only scratched the surface in the county where I was district attorney, because there's some really terrible things that people do to one another. And one case that still haunts me till this day was a child who had been severely beaten repeatedly by his mother. And essentially, he had ruptured vital organs and he was bleeding internally. He was dying. And he was sitting on the steps, of the second floor, and still calling for his mother because he was in such pain. And his mother was the person who inflicted all these injuries that killed him. And that case has never left my mind.
That has got to be absolutely crazy. I can't even fathom what the research, all the investigating that you have to do when it comes to those kind of cases, how that doesn't just keep you up at night.
Well, yeah, I mean, as I said, you have to separate yourself from the work that you do, whether it's as a prosecutor or whether it's as a parole board member or whether it's a criminal defense attorney. And you have to do the same thing in other professions as well. I mean, you look at a lot of horrible cases on a regular basis, and if you went home every night and stared at the ceiling and thought about those cases, you might have quit doing this a while ago. But you can't do that because, you're doing a service to the public and educating them. And, prosecutors, parole board members, criminal defense attorneys have a responsibility as well.
Yeah, I mean, it does. Yeah, I mean, you have a responsibility to, your constituents and the people that, expect you to do your job. I mean, that is definitely the job of a district attorney, is to, bring the hard cases, to trial and to close them out and try to bring some closure to families. Do you feel like, as during your time as a district attorney, did you come across any cases where, the family was, not involved, but like you had gotten close with the family and it became more of like a passion thing? Like, we need to get this solved because this family is, I know every case is important, but mm-hmm. there are some cases that stand out.
Well, yeah, in terms of investigation, typically as a prosecutor, our office was there to aid the law enforcement during the course of their investigation. We didn't really have an extensive detective bureau that actually got involved in the investigations themselves. Typically, In the county where I was district attorney, it was the state police who handled most of the major crimes. There were some exceptions. There's a city, Newcastle, in the county that I was the district attorney that had their own police force that did those things. But a lot of major crimes were handled by the state police. They would always bring in major crime unit guys from neighboring counties. So you really had a great investigative arm of the state police who did all the homicides and rapes and things like that. We were typically counsel to that. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Yeah. So major crimes were typically investigated by the Pennsylvania State Police. They would bring in troopers from neighboring counties who were investigators. So they did an excellent job. And basically, we served more as counsel to them as they conducted these investigations. We really weren't, on the ground involved in the investigations. Now, every major crime, I would go out to the crime scene. So I knew what the crime scene looked like, and other assistant district attorneys in my office would. So most of our contact with families would be after an investigation was complete and an arrest was made. And then we'd be more involved with the victim's families or the victim, him or herself. And we always gave great deference to the family and to the victims and what their concerns were and what you know, what they were, what was most important to them. I mean, they really couldn't, you know, trump our decisions on things, but we certainly wanted to know how they felt and why they felt the way that they did.
Yeah, that makes sense. That definitely makes sense. And I would feel, I mean, I would imagine that you feel a sense of relief when you do bring a case and obviously you get a conviction, and there has to be some sort of, you know, not like you're, but I mean, how do I put this? It's because there's never going to be closure for a lot of those families that lost loved ones. But if you can provide justice, that has to be something that is satisfying.
Well, right. I mean, that's what we thought our responsibility was to be just and to present a case that we thought we could prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And, you know, certainly you're never going to bring a loved one back, like you mentioned, but you know, at least the families of victims and even victims themselves, when it wasn't a homicide, at least could feel that the system served their interests, that justice was done, and that somebody was held responsible for the terrible crime.
Now, one of the things, just to kind of change things up here, we talked about when we were at CrimeCon together, is I talked about Youngstown. You mentioned you were close to Youngstown, and I had mentioned, you know, back in the day that, you know, there used to be a decent mafia connection down there, and I don't know if it still exists, you know, whatever. And
yeah,
I guess I asked you if you had any cases that involved any of the mafia around that area. Did that ever come across your plate?
Well, you know, not directly. I mean, you know, what we were involved in at various times were gambling investigations and gambling prosecutions. And, you know, you could make that connection to Youngstown or Pittsburgh or Cleveland, you know, because there's sort of a gamblers, illegal gambling hierarchy, you know, that stretches from your neighborhood all the way back to some major city. Now, there's been a huge impact on that, you know, because of, you know, gambling has been legalized. So in Pennsylvania, you know, we have casinos all over the place. You know, you can go to those casinos and you can bet on athletic competitions. And, you know, now you can go on FanDuel on your cell phone in Pennsylvania and bet, you know, bet on the Kentucky Derby. I mean, if you were smart in Pennsylvania and you're getting ready to watch the Derby and you pull your phone out on FanDuel and put $100 on, what was it? The 80-1 favorite, you'd have done all right. Yeah. And here's an interesting story though. You know, so in Ohio, for instance, you can't bet online like that, right? So people from Ohio come right across the line to where we are, and they basically drive around in circles or sit in parking lots and bet on FanDuel. You know, it's incredible.
Are you serious?
yeah. You know, but so that was kind of the main thing that I was involved in. But Youngstown traditionally, you know, they had you know, mob influences that were driven out of Pittsburgh, not necessarily Cleveland. And, you know, but there was a series of indictments for corruption over a span. You may remember Jim Traficant.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So
the hair.
So he was the sheriff of Mahoning County, which is Youngstown. And he got indicted for corruption and represented himself and was found not guilty in federal court, and that's what launched his congressional career. So then he went, you know, his congressional career, which was crazy, you know, with his staying, you know, beam me up, Scotty, and all those other kind of things that he used to say and do. He lived on a boat, you know, on a river in Washington D.C. And he got indicted again, second time around, and this time he got convicted and went to prison. But because of these FBI and U.S. attorney investigations, you know, they prosecuted county commissioners, the district attorney. In fact, when I first got elected district attorney, the district attorney in Ohio and Mahoney County, who ultimately got indicted and went to prison, he lost an election, surprisingly, by kind of a an up and comer, a former police officer. Well, the mob went in and shot that new DA in his house before he was sworn into office. They tried to essentially assassinate him because he wasn't mob connected. He's still the DA over there. Paul Gaines is his name. But yeah, they went into his home and they shot him. So yeah, it's you know, Youngstown has a long history, you know, blowing cars up and all the kind of stuff you see in the movies.
None of that actually came into your territory, which is good. That's good. I mean, don't get me wrong, some of your cases are terrible. The thrill killing is one that will stand out to me. And were there any other cases that stood out to you as far as ones that you think that the listeners should know about? That maybe are actually unsolved even?
Well, you know, of course, there's always going to be unsolved homicides. You know, bodies that are found and never recovered. I mean, never arrests made or prosecuted. You know, so, and I'm just trying to think of the case that would stand out. I mean, another homicide case, which was unusual, was a, you know, a 65-year-old guy who shot a young guy, about 24 years old, shot him a couple of times. They were in a party, they were in a house, they were all doing drugs and things like that. But this is an elderly guy who had no violence in his history, which is unusual. And he comes out, shoots him, and the young guy tries to crawl away, and he just walks over and basically executes him. And, you know, most of the time, as you know, I mean, people age out of violent crime, you know, so you might be, you know, a real, you know, badass when you're in your teens and 20s. But as you get older, even into your 30s, you're less likely to be committing violent crimes. And, you know, certainly when someone rolls into the age of 65 and they have no real history of violence, to shoot somebody and then shoot them execution style is really unusual. And so that was a case that stood out as well.
You never know what people are up to. And that is one of the things that had been really interesting as a DA, because again, like we talked about, like you get to see kind of behind the scenes. Like we started with the Depp Heard trial and how that's behind the scenes and opening the curtain, and you get to see it on a daily basis, or when you were the district attorney, you got to see that on a daily basis. So that definitely gives you a much different perspective than, say, you know, some true crime podcaster like myself. So it's great to have people like yourself on the show and share the knowledge, because really everybody wants to know about these cases. And I really think that, you know, with your book, it brings up a lot of questions about the death penalty and, you know, where things stand. And your whole, I mean, you have a whole presence in this business, in this industry. So I am just very grateful. Is there any last things that you would like to say about where you can find your book or anything along those lines?
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. My book was published by McFarland and Company. So McFarland and Company, you can go onto their website, or you can find it on, you know, Barnes and Noble and Amazon and all those booksellers as well online. So, yeah, please do. I'd love to hear from readers, and I also want to compliment you on your podcast. It's great. You know, I've had an opportunity to listen in, and I saw firsthand at CrimeCon how people were kind of flocking over you and are on you like a rock star. Whatever you're doing, it's working. So it's all good.
Well, I appreciate that. I wouldn't go that far, but you know, hey, all the kind words always make a good day. Matt, thank you so much for being a guest on Who Killed. And are you on social or anything like that? Can anybody follow you?
Yeah. So you can follow me on Twitter at Matthew T. Mangino. And you can also go to my blog, which is mattmangino.com. And, you know, I'd love to hear from your listeners. It would be tremendous.
Yeah. And I see that update that regularly. So that would be a great place for any listeners who have any questions for Matt Mangino to definitely reach out and check out his blog. It's really extensive and there's a lot of cool things on there. So thanks so much again, Matt. And
all right,
you have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you. Well, guys, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with former district attorney Matthew Mangino. Again, we met at CrimeCon 2022 in Las Vegas. And again, there will be another CrimeCon in the UK this June, as well as in September of 23 in Orlando. So definitely would love to see you guys there. Again, Who Killed has a booth with killer podcasts and some of our other shows. So it's really great. And it's a great way to get out there and meet some of the listeners. So if you guys get a chance, check it out. But thank you so much to Matthew and I should say Matt Mangino for joining me. He is a very busy guy. Again, check out all his stuff on mattmangino.com. He literally is on TV like once a week. So I would say it's definitely worth checking out. As you guys know, I do drop new episodes every Friday. And again, now that CrimeCon's over, the big move, all that good stuff, and back in the swing of things. So next week should be another interesting episode. Still working on the Patrick Kearney stuff. And again, if you do want to help support the podcast, you can donate via Venmo at my username at bill-huffman-3 or via PayPal on the Slow Burn Media website, I should say. And just click on the donate button on the right-hand side. And again, that goes right to the shows. So that would be great. And again, thanks so much to the listeners for tuning in this week. And as always, if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can. It's at BillHuffman3. The shows that I have coming down the pipeline, as well as updates about previous cases, I kind of post periodically. And I'm not as active as I once was, but it is still a good way to communicate with the listeners. So check it out. And again, that's at BillHuffman3. And again, thank you so much for listening this week. And as always, be healthy and stay safe.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I could no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get 6,000 cash, give us each 3,000, we give you this. Uh-huh. You go home, and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com. or wherever fine podcasts are found.
Are you tired of seeing your teen or young adult struggle on a path that clearly isn't the right fit? Is your teenager confused about which direction to take after high school? The future of work is changing rapidly, and our kids need to know all of the options available after high school so they're empowered to make the choice that is best for them. In each episode, we explore the latest trends that are shaping the opportunities of today and tomorrow. I'm your host, Betsy Jewell, and this is the High School Hamster Wheel Podcast.